Our final speaker, while this is loading, is Eric Vance, and Eric is works with NACASI, the National Council for Air and Stream Improvement, which has been looking at sustainability issues, among a lot of other things, for decades now. So, Eric?
Thank you, Tom. I'd like to build upon some of what has been discussed earlier this morning. Some of it will overlap, and maybe just take a few steps down the road of translating the science into practice, a few ideas along that way. As we've talked about, biomass harvesting involves removal of biomass that we might think of traditionally left on site with shorter rotations, more frequent site entries, which has raised questions about site productivity, water, and wildlife. In response, there have been questions and there have been concerns related to that, and those have led to biomass harvesting guidelines at the state level, also other organizations at national and international levels. Some of these specific provisions relate to how much is retained on site. For instance, 20 to 30% of fine woody debris on site retain and scatter tops from a certain percentage of trees, and restrictions on biomass harvesting or removals on certain types of sites. A lot of these provisions seem to make sense, and I'm sure they're the correct recommendations on some sites. I'm not so sure they're correct for all sites, and I don't know really that we have the science to support these specific recommendations, but they're in good faith estimates of what we need to do, and it's it makes sense, but the question is, do we need these broad restrictions? How important are they? The Michigan woody biomass harvesting guidance also includes some general, I think, valuable insights and ideas about the contributions of residues, the fact that they vary, the contributions both to wildlife and nutrients vary across sites, and biomass harvesting can, in fact, improve forest health and productivity. Some guidelines don't really acknowledge the values, the ecological or values of biomass harvesting, but forest health and productivity, no doubt, in some cases, reducing incidence of insects and disease, as well as fire. Also, the importance of landscape context, particularly as it relates to biodiversity. From the manager perspective, we deal with forest managers and environmental managers from different companies, and they are understandably somewhat concerned about additional restrictions, more complexity that might overlay with what they already have to deal with best management practices and certification systems. I'd like to review some of the studies that many of you, most of you, are familiar with, but just trying to pull out some of the major conclusions from, in this case, the long-term soil productivity study from the first decade. And we know we've heard some reports of more recent studies in as part of the LTSP, that but I don't think they necessarily refute these conclusions that Bob Powers developed in his paper in 2005. It's really the most comprehensive harvesting soil network. It's across North America. As we've seen, the harvesting intensities vary from bowl only to all the way to forest floor and harvest and with and without compaction. These were in the initial stages. I was involved in some of the discussions about LTSP. It was always stressed that it is not intended to mimic operational practices. I think we all kind of make that connection, though, but we need to keep in mind that this is not really an operational study. It has operational components in some cases, but we have to keep that context in mind. Also, fertilization and mitigation practices are not really an inherent part of the core design. I think that's important to consider as well. Some of the conclusions from Bob's 2005 review, Complete removal of surface organic matter leads to significant and universal declines in soil carbon concentration, but this is due to loss of forest floor, not residues. That's important. Also, the absolute mass of soil carbon shows little change. There's some changes in bulk density that are a part of that, but I think that's an important part of that conclusion. Removing all surface organic matter had no noticeable effect on vegetative growth over 10 years. I mean, this was really, I think, a pretty shocking finding, that general finding that no significant effect across most of these sites. There's some exceptions, and there's been some exceptions here and there since this review, but Aspen is one with effects on sprouting. Compaction effects were found to depend a lot on understory competition, and this is a recurring theme we see on a lot of these studies, is the importance of competition and whether it's controlled and the important influence it has. In this case, when competition was present, there tended to be more effects of compaction on the subsequent tree growth, a tendency for reductions on fine textured soils, as we've heard earlier today, and actual increases in some coarse textured soils due to increased water retention. At least that's the most common explanation. Another important and more recent review by Pifo and others in earlier this year, I think is important to note because it covers boreal and temperate forests, over 53 studies, not really a meta-analysis, but along that same line, looking at response ratios. They found in general, and I think we can all sympathize with this, no universal or definitive indices of site sensitivity to forest biomass harvesting. One size definitely doesn't fit all. This should be an important component of any biomass harvesting guidelines, is the site variability in response. Soil carbon concentration and content was significantly reduced only in boreal and subtropical climates, and that's the forest floor rather than residues. Harvest residues, and only one site out of all the studies showed a strong, significant reduction in mineral soil carbon. That was a boreal forest site with a coarse textured carbon-poor soil. So again, kind of following the findings of the 2005 LTSP study, many sites are resilient. Doesn't mean all sites are. In terms of base cations, which is often cited as a concern, reduced base cations were found in foliage and forest floor following whole tree harvesting, rarely significant in the mineral soil, and the depletion was much less than expected from theoretical assessments. So maybe this is where the atmospheric deposition and tapping into some of those reserves deep in the ground or from parent material might play a role that's not being incorporated. And no links from base cation effects, for instance, the foliage and forest floor effects to reduce tree growth. That doesn't mean that effects aren't down the road, but so far from these studies, quite a comprehensive look of a large range of studies, no significant links to tree growth. Also, there was a tendency to find for reduced ceiling height after 5 years. This was a little more evident in northern forests, primarily due to nitrogen deficiency. Some evidence of P deficiency, as we might expect in southern pine systems on highly weathered soils. But in this case, I think in most at least managed southern pine systems, you would be using fertilizer to augment that. And also, almost universally positive influence of whole tree harvesting on seedling survival, which is linked to microclimate. And that's, I think, an underappreciated effect. We've heard a little bit about it in some of our other talks today, the importance of microclimate. We tend to focus more on nutrients than microclimate. I'd like to just touch on a few of the studies that we're supporting that I think are relevant. We tend to support studies that are the cream of the crop, the best available studies. In terms of investigators, we have to kind of take what's available. I'm not talking about this in particular, but it's So there's some trade-offs involved in studies that we support. Fall River is, of course, a long-standing and probably one of the most important studies, particularly in the Northwest, looking at kind of the model of the LTSP, but incorporating some of the operational components that are not as much a part of the traditional Forest Service LTSP. The harvest intensity treatments ranging from conventional bole only to all the way to total tree and legacy wood removal. You can see the contrast there. The findings after 5 and 11 years, I'm not going to spend much time since because of Rob's presentation earlier. Little effect of harvest intensity on tree growth. Again, that's not necessarily what we would expect. This is a high fertility site, which can have an influence relative to maybe some poorer sites. Overwhelming effect of competition control, consistent with what we found or what has been found in LTSP. Residue effects tend to have had more influence on microclimate, that's temperature and moisture, than nutrients. This may play out differently as time goes on. We saw some interesting trends from Paul's study that microclimate might be more important initially, and then nutrient effects may be a bigger part of it down the road. Soil nitrate retention. I don't know how important this is in terms of the total budget, but it's certainly a mechanism that we haven't really appreciated that could play a role. Another study that was completed a number of years ago, it's led by Mark Eisenbees and Jim Berger at Virginia Tech, looked at the effects of wet and dry harvesting on subsequent productivity and soil properties of a forest in loblolly pine in South Carolina. And what they did, instead of imposing particular treatments, they used an operational study and rated the degree of soil disturbance and residue disturbance on a grid pattern and tried to link those effects to actual subsequent tree growth and soil properties. So it's a unique approach that I think we can learn something about. And I think one of the points I'd like to make from this study is the effects of the operational context. In this case, these are the 10-year effects of wet weather harvesting on stand biomass relative to the previous stand. And this is for physical disturbance and residue disturbance, or how much residue is left versus how much is taken off. And in each case, we have a minimal, moderate, and heavy without and with bedding in both cases. And we actually have some, in terms of both physical disturbance and residue disturbance, some actual counterintuitive positive influence of more disturbance. Again, this may be something related to soil physical properties that may or may not hold down the road. But I think the important point here is the overwhelming effect of bedding. In this case, a water limitation with bedding, much higher productivity relative to the previous stand at 10 years, and regardless of residue and physical disturbance. So when we impose treatments such as harvest residue removal, we need to consider what the foresters already know in operating in that system and what the limiting factors are, and to incorporate those in some of the treatments, whether they be something like bedding or fertilization or weed control or other types of site preparation, for instance. Another study that is just getting underway that I thought would worth mentioning, and this is with Michigan Tech and Plum Creek in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And in this case, it's looking at a chronosequence of stands that have been harvested over the course of 30 years in the past with and without residue removal. And this will look at above and below ground carbon and nutrient pools, plant productivity, and plant community structure. In addition, at least two of the time frames since harvesting, they're going to look at a perpendicular gradient of contrasting soils. So you have this chronosequence, but also at various points in time, you'll have a study of the effects of those residues on contrasting soils and what the stand structure, what the productivity and some of the soil and nutrient and carbon and nutrient properties will be. So that'll be interesting to see how that evolves. Another recently established study a couple years ago is with the actually USDA AFRI funded primarily in conjunction with North Carolina State, and something we're supporting with the University of Georgia on the soils part is looking at residue management effects on loblolly pine, not only removal but how it's managed. So in this case it's 8 sites in North Carolina and Georgia, harvest treatments with stem only, with residues retained or whole tree, and either and residues are removed, and either all residues are removed or within operational limitations, or 15 or 30% of those residues are retained, either in a clumped or dispersed pattern. So we know that it's not only how much we take off, but how we manage it that might affect the subsequent properties in stand. And this will look at not only soil productivity issues, but also small mammals, reptiles, amphibians, arthropods. How does the retention and the clumped versus spread residues, how do they affect these different components of the wildlife components, also plant community composition, soil properties that Larry Morris is leading, and input from loggers. This is a very important technology transfer component to this study, both in terms of getting input on the feasibility of these practices as they evolve and some of the biomass harvesting guidelines provisions, as well as providing technical input going forward in a practical sense. So this is a good example of linking some of the science and the practical aspects, the operational aspects, and how they come together. Here from that study, this shows the contrast in no retention with no biomass harvesting guidelines to a 30% retention. And it looks like, you know, there is some difference there. But when we actually go to this is how much is measurements of how much is retained on these different studies, 4 replicates in North Carolina, not including the Georgia replicates yet. In this case, we have the different treatments are clear cutting with no biomass harvesting and clear cutting with just operational biomass harvesting, and then either 30% retention clustered or dispersed or 15% retention clustered or dispersed. And to me, the take-home message is there's not a lot of difference. At least I think the variability is high. I don't have standard deviations here, but the initial impression is that there's not a lot of difference, even though with all the effort going in to retaining this extra biomass. And I think the most feasible explanation is that there is quite a bit of variability, even across these selected sites, in how much non-stem biomass there is, how much a hardwood component, for instance. And this will affect how much is left on the site. So we get back to that question of how much is taken off, how much is left, and the question of whether these kinds of biomass harvesting guideline provisions are really meaningful in terms of site productivity or other ecological attributes for the system. And this same pattern seemed to hold for the Georgia sites as well. And that's preliminary information, but I think the data is pretty good so far. Another, I think, question that comes up in terms of practice and science is how clean are biomass harvesting sites. I think I'm influenced by some of these LTSP and other similar treatments that are taking everything off, and that's a good baseline to go from. The extreme is how important are these different components, but it kind of presents an image in your mind about what biomass harvesting is. You think of clean sites, and in actuality, I think in most current situations, there's actually quite a bit left, and we need to do perhaps a better job at documenting the range of biomass that's already left given current technology. that may be more important and may provide quite a lot of input benefit for the site and for other attributes of the system. Of course, this could change as technologies increase and improve. More and more, especially in Scandinavia, for instance, and elsewhere, there's technologies increasing more that biomass operationally is being removed. So we have to keep track on that. Another question related to practice is we tend to use the baseline or for comparison of what's been left in the past with our past practices, but we need to be aware that in most cases that material wasn't left and spread, distributed throughout the site. Most cases it might have been piled, and in many cases piled and burned. And if there are benefits to the site, they certainly aren't even across the site. So I think that's another consideration. Important to look at a first go of how much, just from a nutrient budget standpoint, how much is left, how much is taken off. This was an analysis by Mark Eisenbees and several of us a couple years ago, looking at just for southern pine, how much would traditionally be left on site with stem-only harvest, how would that change with a whole tree harvest, how much fertilizer is needed. So that's a good first step. It doesn't show everything. Another, I think, important context in something that was brought up earlier in Stape's presentation is the contrast with traditional agriculture. We know that agricultural production has been sustained for many years, given appropriate inputs. And this is a contrast in biomass and nutrient or nitrogen removal for these different forest systems, loblolly pine, Douglas fir, hybrid poplar, with and without these two different sites, high site and low site for hybrid poplar, in this case removing everything, and Douglas fir high and low sites. This is the stem and then the residue, which may or may not be removed for loblolly pine, Douglas fir, compared to corn and wheat. We see that for biomass removals and production that the high end of intensive forestry can be in the same range as some of the agricultural systems, but with nitrogen and other nutrients, the tendency is for a lot less to be taken off. That doesn't mean that there won't be nutrient deficiencies and nutrients may need to be replaced, but I think it's good to look at that context. Another thing is we can replace a lot of these nutrients through just wood ash or other soil amendments, and it's just, of course, we have to incorporate the transportation availability of these other amendments like wood ash. But for calcium and phosphorus in particular, this shows for a reasonable amount of wood ash addition for spruce fir, northern hardwood, loblolly pine, and central hardwood. Over three harvests, a lot of that could be replaced and recycled back to the site. And this has been used for many years in Scandinavia, and they do have, I think, a recycling ethic and also a sustainable forestry ethic where it can still be considered sustainable to have a diagnose a nutrient limitation and correct that limitation with fertilizer or some other tool, mitigation tool, whether it be wood ash fertilizer or some other management approach. And I think we've in some areas of the U.S. and Canada, we have that. In other contexts, we tend to think, I think there's a certain community that thinks that it's not sustainable if we have to add anything to it, but it's not really reasonable, as Dale Johnson has stated in his talk, that we can continue to remove an intensive rate and not expect to have to add something back, at least in certain situations. And also, we've heard about different components of the nutrient cycles, in this case, calcium. And Ruth Yane has done a lot of good work on how much can be derived from some of the deep sources. But we also have inputs such as atmospheric deposition that are often ignored in the long term. They might be small on a yearly basis, but more significant later on. This was incorporated by David Griegel into his revision of the Minnesota Generic Environmental Impact Statement. And he concluded from this is, for instance, calcium, much higher calcium here, way off the chart compared to anything that would be removed in whole tree harvest. And he concluded for typical soils across Minnesota that there'd be many opportunities for harvesting repeatedly without any problem. Now, when you go to coarse textured soils and organic soils, maybe the worst case scenarios in that region, we still have over 20-year rotations. He estimated less than 5% of the calcium would be removed. Of course, that could be remedied by additions to the system. In the case of organic soils, he saw a greater potential for potassium and phosphorus depletion if aggressive biomass removal is routinely practiced. So can nutrient deficiencies be corrected? Unfortunately, this looks to be changing, but there are few, what I've seen, formal fertigation mitigation treatments associated with biomass harvesting. So you have the biomass harvesting and incorporating the positive treatments along with that core design. We see that changing in some of the work that we saw in that's evolving in Canada and elsewhere, that they're actually imposing some of those treatments. There is evidence, of course, that deficiencies can be corrected. Some of the work by Andy Scott and Tom Dean showed that the nitrogen or phosphorus deficiencies with whole tree removal on some sites in the southeast, and you add fertilizer and it totally replenishes the phosphorus and the trees grow better than before. So that's not a surprise, but something we kind of overlook in the mentality that we're not supposed to add anything back. But also we have to recognize that fertilization is not an option on some lands. There are either management restrictions such as federal lands or economic considerations. There's a tendency for more of this, I think, in the Northeast and in boreal forests. Maybe the economics is not there or there are other restrictions, so we don't have all the tools available. I think we're also learning that secondary effects, such as the competition control, are often underestimated. And the fact that this can be actually a universal driver, at least through some part of the rotation, whether or not competition is there, and the interaction between residues and competition, and also residues and microclimate effects. More work is needed, and we saw some good evidence, I think, that this is moving forward in a positive way to document and define the sensitive sites, identify what specific factors are limiting, assess the effects of repeated removals across multiple rotations, and improve indicators and monitoring protocols. A good assessment of that included a review of soil indicators by Jim Berger and Andy Scott found that the most serious monitoring pitfall were indicators with no cause and effect relationship with soil service, such as soil productivity. So we might be changing things. We might be monitoring and seeing a change. That doesn't necessarily mean it's not sustainable in terms of productivity, at least. A change may not be bad, and in some cases, maybe positive. So we need to do a better job connecting our indicators and monitoring to the actual outcomes that we're hoping to achieve. Also, disturbance may be detrimental in one ecosystem and beneficial in another. And so we can conclude by some observations about low intensity versus high intensity management. Low intensity management that we might have on more of our federal lands might involve infrequent harvesting. So we might see that potential problems might be reduced, but on the other hand, we might have less frequent monitoring, fewer mitigation options, which may actually result in somewhat higher risk than a higher intensity management regime where there's more removed, but then there's more options at the table for mitigating any deficiencies that develop. So one question I'll just lay out on the table is whether we can do a better job at the site-based monitoring indicators, not necessarily to replace restrictions, but but in some cases to augment them. And these maybe developing regimes that are more allow more flexibility for managers, that also the managers would adhere to best management practices and certification principles, but focusing more on achieving sustainability through monitoring and any changes in the system that we could correct what we might call functional mitigation. That's not mitigating back to some prehistoric state or some system state before the treatments were imposed, but more to a productivity state so we can sustain that value that we're trying to achieve in the end. So thank you very much.